Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Trump, in his State of the Union address on February 4th, stressed the importance of having local authorities cooperate with federal agencies when it comes to immigration enforcement. Ohio law enforcement agencies and justice officials have different approaches to working with immigration and customs enforcement. For example, a Cincinnati judge is under fire for calling ICE on defendants he suspects are undocumented residents. Washington Post reporter Teo Armas covers immigration and covered this issue in his last job with the Charlotte Observer. Welcome to the show, Teo.
Thank you so much for having me.
Immigration enforcement has been a staple of President Trump's agenda, but not all local authorities are cooperating with ICE. Has his administration taken any concrete steps to mandate cooperation at this point?
Well, yeah, there was actually an effort under Jeff Sessions back in 2017 to try and, essentially order and force local jurisdictions to honor immigration detainers, which are essentially these requests from ICE that a local sheriff holds someone in jail for up to 48 hours so that ICE can come and detain that person if, you know, they suspect that that person is an undocumented immigrant. A lot of these things have been litigated in the courts. Some of them are still stuck in the courts. But, there's been countless efforts from the Trump administration to try and force in one way or another local sheriffs, other local elected officials to try and help them out when it comes to the issue of immigration.
When it comes to these detainers, that is a move that's instigated by ICE. Just as an example, I know it's not necessarily your bailiwick, what's happening in Cincinnati, but the judge is taking it upon himself to identify people he suspects are here illegally. That's not the same thing, right?
No. So those are two very different things. I think a lot of people were really, shocked. And I think the reason that Judge Ruhlman in Cincinnati made national news is because that's really unusual for a judge to call ICE and basically say, hey, here is this person in my courtroom that I suspect of being in the country illegally. Can you come get them? ICE has certainly arrested people in courthouses before, but I think this is really one of the first times that a judge is, going out of his way to flag down ICE and get them to come to his courthouse. Detainers are a totally separate mechanism. It's much more formalized under this program called Secure Communities. And basically when, someone is arrested, they're taken to jail, their fingerprints are taken. Those fingerprints get sent to the federal government, to these databases that are mostly managed by the FBI, but that ICE also has access to. ICE will, run through those fingerprints, and if they find a match with their fingerprints, lists of people that they suspect are in the country illegally, they will issue this detainer over to local sheriffs. Whether or not the sheriff actually follows that detainer is, something that is becoming increasingly contested in the Trump era, but it's a much more formalized system. It's not just a judge picking up the phone and calling officials.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about the obligation by local political subdivisions. That could be anything from a judge's bench to a sheriff's office and how they work with ICE. A proposed state house bill would make cooperation pretty much uniform for local governments in Ohio, and that would use federal and state funds as a carrot or a stick, depending, I guess, on your point of view. So we're talking about the role of local government and working or not with federal immigration officials. My guest right now is Teo Armas. He is a reporter for The Washington Post. He previously covered immigration for The Charlotte Observer as well. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You said it's becoming increasingly contentious. Has there been an uptick in pushback from local officials across the country?
Absolutely. I think, what you're really seeing now is a lot of sheriffs who are coming out and declaring and saying, I'm not going to honor these ICE detainers, which essentially is declaring themselves a sanctuary city, a sanctuary county. Obviously, the definitions of that term can get a little bit hazy. And I know even in Franklin County at one point, the sheriff said, we're not, you know, necessarily a sanctuary county, but in effect was acting like one. But, you know, in Charlotte, North Carolina, in Mecklenburg County, where I was last year, you actually had a new sheriff who successfully ran on a platform of limiting the county's cooperation with ICE. And he's certainly not the only person who's done that. You know, on the other hand, ICE has really stepped up its attacks and almost, you know, shamed publicly these sheriffs, including the one in Franklin County, who don't necessarily comply with ICE detainers. So you have both sides kind of doing a little bit more, and certainly, you know, more people at the local level and also at the state level pushing back and saying that they refuse to honor immigration detainers, in large part because of the argument that they violate the Constitution. They go against people's Fourth Amendment rights.
You brought up the issue of sanctuary county or city or whatever, and that by a sheriff saying that unless it's part of the case that's before them, they're not going to respond to those requests, to the detainer requests. What is there a legal definition of a sanctuary political subdivision at this point?
Not really, no. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something that's really debated amongst a lot of people, you know, but and there's obviously different gradations of it. But I think in effect, you know, the issue that a lot of people focus on is detainers specifically, you know, is whether mm-hmm. you honor detainers or whether you don't honor detainers, whether that's a codified aspect of policy, which in some counties and some jurisdictions it is,
okay.
Or whether it's simply a practice that you don't honor them. And it can get even more complicated than that. You know, there are some counties, this is true of Winston-Salem in North Carolina, where they won't honor detainers, they won't hold someone for ICE. But when they're releasing someone that ICE lodged a detainer on, they'll call ICE up and say, hey, this person is walking out of jail. And in the case of Winston-Salem, ICE's office is right down the street from the local jail. So it's fairly easy for them to go apprehend someone after they're out of jail. To go back to your question, the definition of a sanctuary city, I mean, that depends on who you ask.
Are there consequences for not responding to detainer requests?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, consequences is one of those things that it depends how you look at it. At least certainly one of the things that ICE has tried to do is put out these press releases, you know, these various sorts of communications that get picked up really quickly in local media saying, hey, there is this person with these really violent charges or in some cases convictions. The sheriff chose to release them, which is not really quite accurate, but ICE has basically mounted this kind of campaign to try and, like I said, publicly shame people who don't honor detainers. That said, detainers are voluntary, and there's not all that much that at this point, just because of how contested this issue is within the courts, that the federal administration can really do to punish jurisdictions that don't honor those detainers. It can get complicated, and, you know, perhaps people have heard about, you know, what's happening in New York right now with Global Entry, which is a separate thing, but the administration is certainly trying to use many different avenues. A lot of those avenues ultimately get kind of caught up in lawsuits.
What's the Global Entry issue?
So that is basically New York State passed this law that effectively allows undocumented immigrants to get driver's licenses, you know, prevents federal authorities from getting access to its logs, to New York State's logs of people who have driver's licenses, in effect, to protect undocumented immigrants. And the Trump administration kind of, some might say retaliated, some might say reacted, but, you know, they certainly mentioned that in their justification for cutting off for all residents of New York, whether they're citizens or, you know, legal immigrants with papers and documented immigrants, said that they can no longer use Global Entry or similar sorts of programs that let you, you know, cut lines at the airport.
Huh. Okay. You brought up driver's licenses, and an immigration lawyer contacted me and said that really states, including Ohio, began to deny driver's licenses to anyone who could not prove that they were in this country legally. That kind of set off a ticking time clock, a time bomb kind of, for people being, you know, driving without driver's licenses, that kind of a thing, and creating situations of a crime being committed.
Exactly. And then, you know, they might end up in jail, and then a detainer might be issued for that specific person. Mm-hmm. And ICE might try and, you know, get that person in the immigration proceedings pipeline. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of advocates, certainly a lot of immigration lawyers who are working on behalf of immigrants, say that DUIs, those sorts of things, are not really, you know, traffic violations. Driving without a license are things that aren't really worth deporting someone over, are not worth separating families over. You know, but on the other hand, you certainly have cases that maybe include situations that are a little bit more severe, and sheriffs who do comply with ICE say that they have a responsibility to protect public safety. So it's complicated, and there's arguments on both sides.
You know, speaking of public safety, the president in his State of the Union address used a couple examples of some pretty heinous crimes committed by people who are in the country illegally. And I was wondering if you could tell us if there's a sense about how common that is and what that represents nationally.
Right. I mean, I think obviously that question is going to, the answer to that question, I think, is going to depend on who you ask. Overall, just based on the research that I've seen, the stats that I've seen, immigrants in this country tend to commit violent crimes at lower rates than U.S. citizens. But there, you know, I mean, there are these cases, and the Trump administration certainly capitalizes on them. I'm sure people will remember the Kate Steinle case out of, I think that was in San Francisco, where, you know, an undocumented immigrant killed this woman, and you know, really tries to weaponize those, some might say, in order to really make its political case and you know, get constituents really riled up, you know, get constituents calling their sheriffs and saying, okay, why aren't you honoring ICE detainers? So, you know, it, again, there are always going to be cases that that really kind of get pinpointed and used as examples of something much larger. But there's really a whole mix of different cases there, whether you're talking about DUIs or stuff that's really violent and horrible.
And I apologize if you brought this up already, but have you seen an increase in state legislation intended to encourage or discourage cooperation?
Yes. So there's certainly been a number of different bills passed kind of both on either side. I mean, there's, I'm thinking right now off the top of my head, there's one in Texas, there's California. I mean, all these states that I think we sort of traditionally think of as very to the left or very much to the right have passed legislation, you know, either forcing counties to comply with immigration detainers, which in Texas's case, actually, that was overruled by the federal courts, you know, or in California's case, preventing local jurisdictions from complying with immigration detainers. And as I'm sure one of your guests later on in the hour will explain, now that might be, you know, a possibility in Ohio, although to my knowledge, it's certainly not the first time that that kind of legislation has been introduced.
And in 2018, 75 former judges signed on to a letter to the then acting director of ICE urging that courthouses should be off limits, like churches and schools, that kind of a thing. Did that have any impact on anything?
Not to my knowledge. You know, kind of going back to what you were saying about churches, so ICE has this thing called the sensitive locations policy, which is basically places that are off limits, places they can't go and arrest people. That's why I think in Columbus there's one or two cases of people who have taken sanctuary in churches, you know, where they move into a church in order to protect themselves from ICE, from some kind of deportation order that they have. Courthouses for now are still fair game, which is why you have a judge like the one in Cincinnati calling immigration officials and you know, ultimately having defendants in his courtroom get picked up by ICE. That letter from what I know has not really moved the needle on that one all that much yet. But again, I mean, it's one of those issues that's contentious, and there's when I was in Charlotte, you know, I think it was the sheriff there had passed a policy saying that whenever ICE goes into courtrooms, it has, you know, an official from ICE has to be accompanied by a local official. There have been efforts, I think this is in New York again, to try and, you know, bar ICE, at least under state law, from entering courthouses. So there's been efforts, but I think detainers have been a much more frequent subject of state legislation.
Teo Armas, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me.
Teo Armas is a reporter for The Washington Post. He covers immigration, which he did as well previously for the Charlotte Observer. Coming up, we're going to hear from the American Immigration Lawyers Association and also the executive director of the Buckeye State Sheriff's Association about this legislation that is going to be introduced in the Ohio House, making it uniform, the response by local political subdivisions to requests from ICE. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. Ohio law enforcement agencies and justice officials have different approaches for working with immigration and customs enforcement. Some notify ICE when a suspect in a crime also is found to have an immigration violation. Others do not, saying they won't hold a suspect longer than required for the underlying crime. And a proposed state house bill would require uniformity when it comes to how sheriffs and judges and others respond and cooperate with such requests from ICE. Heather Prendergast is an elected director of the Board of Governors for the American Immigration Lawyers Association. She teaches immigration and nationality law at Cleveland Marshall College of Law. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Bob Cornwell is executive director of the Buckeye State Sheriff's Association. It represents Ohio's 88 county sheriffs. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Glad to be here.
ICE has accused the Franklin County Sheriff's Office of releasing 29 people suspected of immigration violations, despite requests to hold the inmates. You know, it's up to the, you know, Franklin County Sheriff to defend the actions. But all things being equal, what do you understand about how other sheriffs in the state of Ohio are responding to these detainer requests?
Well, you have to understand that the 88 sheriffs are all independently elected except for Cuyahoga County, which is appointed. So there are 88 ways to do different things. As far as this issue goes, there are sheriffs that believe that they should be holding them and notify ICE prior to release, and then those who believe that they should notify ICE after they're released. And they should only hold them for a short period of time. Once the case is disposed of at the local level, the inmates, depending on what the charge was, could be processed out rather quickly. Otherwise, they may take a little bit longer. So there's where you get your variance as to when notification occurs.
Is this a conversation that your members are having statewide?
We have not had much of a conversation about it. You know, we have in the past relied on the individual authority of each of the sheriffs to decide how they're going to handle it. But we have one sheriff in the state that does have his personnel in the jail already trained up on the 280G program through the ICE and allows them to detain them for a longer period of time so ICE can pick them up.
Just from a pocketbook point of view, who pays for that when they're detained? Regarding a detainer from ICE.
Well, as with all detainees within the jail, whether they're legal or illegal residents of the county or state, the county picks up the tab for their housing inmates.
There is a proposed state house bill. It hasn't been, I don't think it's been introduced yet, but it would require political subdivisions and like the sheriff's office and police departments and that kind of a thing. It would require them to cooperate with such requests from ICE. What is there? Is there a position yet from the Buckeye State Sheriff's Association?
Since the bill has not yet been introduced, obviously we have not had an opportunity to review the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Once we review the bill, we will take a position. I'm sure that the sheriffs, as is true with other legislative issues, consistency is the best thing we can have statewide. That way you don't have a patchwork quilt of how you look at or work with ICE or without ICE.
Heather Prendergast, this, where do American immigration lawyers fit into this equation at this point?
The American Immigration Lawyers Association is an organization of about over 15,000 law professors and immigration attorneys, and all of them have different views, as one would expect to be reflected nationally. So I can't really speak for what the issues are, what the organization's opinion is of this specifically, but I can say from my experience, having served as chair of AILA's National ICE Liaison Committee for 3 years and a member of it for three additional years, mm-hmm. and in that capacity, we met with ICE leadership in Washington, D.C. twice a year. They attended our conferences a couple times a year, at the national level, and then, of course, we met with the agency locally. There's solid arguments to be made for why, this isn't a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. As the sheriff mentioned, we've got the local municipalities or counties are paying the bill to keep these people locked up for up to 48 additional hours. And my understanding is that ICE doesn't always show up to pick them up within that time frame.
Uh-huh.
And some counties are better equipped than others to foot the bill to detain people for additional days. It also, these detainers, what we've seen from past experiences, that they open up jurisdictions potentially to lawsuits about detaining individuals beyond the required time. Sometimes ICE places a detainer and it turns out the person's actually a U.S. citizen. I think that came up in a case in Michigan within the past year. This isn't some clear-cut bright line, all upside kind of thing. There are certainly some negative aspects to the program. And immigration law is a federal civil law. Okay, so it's not a criminal thing. These are civil matters. And the federal immigration authorities are specially trained in understanding what the law is and what it requires. And you ask any immigration attorney or regular attorney for that matter, and they'll tell you immigration law is really complicated.
Mm-hmm.
So to expect local officials to understand the intricacies of immigration law and be able to make these determinations on, in support of a federal authority, I think is it's a stretch. There's a lot of work to be done. They already have a lot of responsibilities at the local level for their own or communities. And I think this is an additional burden that may be an unreasonable request to expect them to bear.
So there's two issues there, Bob Cornwell, that immigration is a federal civil, not a criminal issue, and that federal officials are specially trained to identify these people and suss out the complexities, that it's not a sheriff's role.
Well, but it is the sheriff's role in the state of Ohio to detain all those who have violated the law or alleged to have violated the law. Understanding the complexities of the immigration laws, not being an attorney, I do understand that completely.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have prosecutors at the local level that assist us in making those determinations. Yes, it is a burden on counties to hold a person an additional 48 hours up to, but we are already housing inmates in the first place. It's not a huge expense to the counties. It's something that we do on a daily basis. It is a civil crime, not a criminal crime, and that's why I said earlier that once the case that brought the individual to our custody is settled, then we start working with ICE as far as notification to remove the individual from a county jail.
But, you know, you said earlier that it's always better to have uniformity, but there's also the issue of local control. Does that play a role in any of the conversations you see going forward, Bob Cornwell?
Well, it will be played out. I understand the home rule in the state of Ohio. I do understand that. But there are issues that need to be addressed uniformly throughout the state of Ohio. We would like to see that with immigration enforcement. We would also like to see that, we already have it with carry concealed weapons,
mm-hmm.
so that individuals who move from location to location, city to city, they know what the law is because it's a state law. You don't have to worry about what I'm doing in this small municipality or village and then going over to another city or town.
Heather Prendergast, have you seen this issue of creating uniformity within a single state? Have you seen it play out in other states yet?
This is not a specific issue that I've been tracking, so I can't say one way or another. I don't know.
What about the issue of the Cincinnati judge who calls ICE when he suspects that somebody is in the country illegally and who is before him?
I think this is something that's within the purview of law enforcement and properly so, because they're the ones on the front lines. They're the ones that are charged with enforcing the laws. And certainly notifying ICE if you suspect that someone may be here without status or in violation of the immigration laws, on the part of local law enforcement, that makes sense because that's their job, right? It's enforcing the law and making sure that everything is handled properly. However, for a judge who's supposed to be, presumably an impartial arbiter of justice, who is supposed to be coming to each of the cases in his or her courtroom with an open mind and focused on, how the facts relate to the law, I find it deeply troubling that, it seems like a bias on the part of the judge to make these judgment calls. And, part of being a lawyer, you want to, that part of being a judge, I would think, is having that appearance of fairness in all matters. And I question how the judge can, be viewed, even if he or she is able to overcome these biases in making their ultimate judgments. The public is going to question their impartiality and the decisions that come out of the courtroom because of these sorts of actions.
Bob Cornwell, before I let you go, what about attaching penalties for failure to cooperate with ICE when it comes to what sheriffs do, attaching penalties such as the loss of federal and state funding for that? Is that what do you make of that tactic?
I find that somewhat reprehensible that they would try to do that. You know, because of the different situations at each one of the county jails, populations fluctuate every day. To say that we do not hold inmates for a period of time seems, you know, unconscionable that they would take our federal funds from us when we're trying to do the best what we can. If the federal government put more money into the county jails, then we could have a discussion about that. But there is no funding that comes from the feds directly for building or the long-term cost of operational for the jails themselves and personnel.
Bob Cornwell, Executive Director of the Buckeye State Sheriff's Association, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Heather Prendergast, Elected Director of the Board of Governors for the American Immigration Lawyers Association, will stay with us. And coming up, we'll hear from one of the sponsors of that legislation. So if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Ohio law enforcement officials and local judges have different tacks when it comes to working with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. A proposed state house bill would require a sheriff's office and other local law enforcement and judicial officials to cooperate when and how ICE requests. The penalty for failure would be loss of federal and state funding streams. Still with us is Heather Prendergast, elected director of the Board of Governors for the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Joining us is State Representative Niraj Antani. He's a Republican from the Dayton suburb of Miamisburg. He's co-sponsor of the measure. Welcome back to the show, Representative Antani.
Thanks for having me, Ann. Good to be back.
You and Representative Candace Keller, a fellow Republican from another Dayton suburb, Middletown, introduced the bill and are going to introduce, or you introduced it last March, right?
Yeah, the bill has actually been introduced in a couple of different General Assemblies now. Representative Keller introduced it in the last General Assembly with the support of then-Treasurer Mandel, and I have now joined her, and we introduced it last year. We've had one hearing on the bill so far.
And what came of that hearing? Was it just sponsor testimony?
Yeah, it was just sponsor testimony. So the bill, as you probably know, defunds sanctuary cities. If a local government or political subdivision, including a school board, passes a resolution or indicates in a certain way, that they will not cooperate with federal immigration authorities or will defy federal immigration authorities, it removes their ability for state funding. And then it also gives the victim of a violent crime of an illegal immigrant recourse to sue that political subdivision and to remove any elected officials that voted to become a sanctuary political subdivision.
What do you mean, remove officials?
Well, so it would give them the opportunity. Let's say that, Joe Buckeye is the victim of a violent crime of an illegal immigrant. Joe Buckeye could then sue, let's say, the Dayton School Board, because the Dayton School Board voted to become a sanctuary school board, could sue the school board. And if he wins that suit, the members of the Dayton School Board who voted in favor of their resolution, which they did last year in the spring, would be removed from office.
These are duly elected officials. You're talking about having a lawsuit by an individual remove elected officials from office?
That's correct. You know, in the way that we see it, you know, they are contributing to the crime, right? If they voted to become a sanctuary school district or sanctuary city, you know, to basically harbor and attract illegal immigrants, that if one of them commits a violent crime, that individual should have recourse against that elected official. You know, other states have recall. We do not. At the state level in Ohio, I think, you know, certain municipalities do. But, you know, this is basically another way to recall, you know, that elected official for an action that they made. They voted for that, and you have to own your vote.
But a recall is an election in and of itself, not a lawsuit.
Sure. Well, you know, we have a judicial process, and you know, we could change the bill to an election if that's, you know, the will of the legislature. But, you know, we have a judicial system for a reason. And, you know, I trust our judges to make the right call.
So this would be what you've just been talking about would be in the cases of people who are accused in violent crimes. What about civil crimes?
Well, you know, I think we could certainly look at that. You know, I believe the bill as it stands now, you know, is a victim of a crime. Now, obviously, a civil crime doesn't really exist. You're either, you know, it's either criminal or it's civil. And so, you know, whether someone has a civil suit against someone, I mean, I would have to figure out, you know, exactly, you know, how that would work. But, you know, this is in regards to, you know, a crime. Now, it's not necessarily, you know, for trespassing, right? I mean, you know, I don't think that, you know, arises to the level, you know, of this, but certainly for violent crime.
Heather Prendergast, thoughts about this legislation as is described by Niraj Antani?
I guess I'm confused about why we're looking for ways to make the jobs of local governments and agencies more complicated than they already are. You know, again, the immigration law is really complex. So someone could be here without status, but you know, they may not have committed a federal immigration crime of illegally entering the country, which is the most common of the actual criminal aspects of immigration would be this illegal entry or reentry. Most of the immigration violations are civil in nature and implicate nothing with respect to criminal law in any way. And if a school board or a local government believes that it is in the best interest of their residents and their communities to have an immigration policy in place that makes members of their communities feel safe because maybe there are a number of immigrant families there and perhaps some of those immigrant families have family members who are, for one reason or another, out of immigration status, perhaps through no fault of their own. It could be as simple as the attorney didn't file the right paperwork on time. Someone overstayed their visa. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's some nefarious aspect about that person. But again, you know, there are communities, and that's where these types of so-called sanctuary policies come from, that want to make sure that their residents feel safe, that want to make sure that if a crime is committed, their residents aren't afraid to call the police to report it, because what if the police find out that their uncle is out of status? Or, you know, they want kids to feel safe coming into school knowing that their mom isn't going to be arrested by ICE after dropping them off. So I guess I just think that that's something that's best left to the local communities. And certainly, you know, there are those communities that decide that they want to have more strict policies in place as well. But I just question why the Ohio State House would want to make the difficult job of governing locally more complicated with these stringent requirements.
Representative Antani, what about that?
Well, you know, I think we have to, I take issue, you know, with a variety of things. You know, first, I would say that, you know, I think language is important, right? When you use language like out of status or, you know, something like that, that really sort of, you know, kind of, you know, underplays what we're talking about. A visa overstay is still a visa overstay. You are either in the country with legal documentation or you're not. And I also want to be very, very clear about the word immigrant. My parents immigrated from India following the legal channels, the legal process in 1978. Okay. If you did not follow the legal process, you are not an immigrant. You are here illegally. And so, you know, we can call you an illegal alien. We can call you an illegal immigrant. But to call someone who is here without proper paperwork an immigrant is just frankly, you know, untrue. Now, someone whose attorney didn't file the correct paperwork, well, you know, you can have a claim against that attorney. But, you know, let's be real and frank. That rarely happens. You know, of the 12 to 15 million illegal immigrants who are in the nation, that is just simply not a common endeavor. And so, you know, as far as making things complicated for local officials, guess what? You know, governing is hard, but local officials don't have jurisdiction over immigration law. The federal government does. And, you know, we think we saw the attorney general, you know, this week, you know, also speak about sanctuary cities and perhaps some federal action regarding them. But local officials do not get to determine whether or not their local governments cooperate with federal immigration authorities.
You know, I mean, all things being equal, it's also not common for people who live here without proper documentation to commit violent crimes. That's much lower than the national average, is it not? So why go after them?
Well, you know, I don't know
the data.
I don't know the data on that particularly. I don't know whether it's at the national average or below or
it's
above.
It's pretty commonly reported as, you know, below the national average. But go ahead.
I just wasn't aware of that. But I guess, you know, first I want to say when we talk about people without documentation, that is again another way of using language to underplay someone who is here illegally. And I would say it is quite an insult to someone like me, whose parents came here legally, that worked hard. I still have cousins and family in India who would love to come to America. I talk to, you know, Indians who are here on H-1B visas all the time who would love a green card, but they can't because of the green card backlog, because Democrats in Washington, you know, care more about illegal immigrants than legal immigrants. But, you know, the bill also, I will say, you know, yes, there is this provision regarding, you know, those who commit a violent act, but that's not really the crux of the bill. The crux of the bill, I would say, is defunding sanctuary cities. So, you know, I you know, understand why we're spending time on talking about this one provision, but, you know, really the crux of the bill is not giving state funds to those who are sanctuary cities or school boards.
So, I just want to point out, you know, if you want to pick apart the language aspect of it, out of status, those are technical terms that come from the law. So, you know, if you want to play politics with it, fine. But the reality is that immigration impacts people, it impacts families, it impacts communities. You know, I'm glad that your family did it the right way. I represent a number of Indians who are at various parts of the green card process. My work is not limited to those in this country who are undocumented. I represent a number of professionals and families as well. So, you know, this isn't some sort of like trickery with the lingo. Words do matter, and pretending that your words are better than mine because they're more inflammatory is frankly what's wrong with all of the politics around immigration. Because if we look at what it actually is, and if we look at it from a human perspective, and we talk to people that it impacts, and we go out to those people and communities, and we have real conversations about this, and don't try to pretend that some words are real and some words aren't. Maybe we'd come to a better understanding on this. But looking at the bill's analysis, it also references the ability of individuals to access public benefits. And I just would point out that these are things that the federal law already addresses. These are things that the federal government is already handling. So I don't understand why the local why the state government here in Ohio needs to muddy the waters further by making things more complicated when these are already addressed in other places. It seems very duplicitous. And again, it seems that this bill or legislation is something that's just designed to further drive divides in our communities rather than actually getting to the heart of the problem and finding common sense solutions to these issues that we're all facing here in Ohio.
I wanted to address an issue, Representative Antani, that was brought up by the Ohio Legislative Service Commission, which provides it's a nonpartisan organization that provides analysis on every bill. It raised concerns about House Bill 169, which you introduced last March. It said, because federal law allows a municipality to decline to participate in voluntary federal immigration enforcement programs, such as ICE detainer requests, and some municipalities do so decline, a court might find that the bill violates an Ohio municipality's home rule power to make that decision. Now, home rule has been raised time and again over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, a lot in the last 4 or 5 years. What is your response to that?
Sure. Well, you know, home rule is always a concern. And, you know, Ohio's home rule statute is a tricky wicket, I will say. You know, obviously there have been a lot of, you know, different legal challenges on different pieces of legislation. You know, quite frankly, you know, the courts will have to play that out. You know, this also applies to townships, counties, and school board who do not have home rule authority. And so, you know, as far as, you know, municipalities go, you know, certainly, you know, they will always use the home rule argument, and sometimes they will win and sometimes they will not.
Let's see. Anita in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Anita.
Hi, Ann. I just wanted to say that I think that a legislator should probably know the statistics on a matter that one is about to propose legislation in regards to.
Okay. I guess you're referring to whether or not the incidence of those kinds of violent crimes among undocumented
right.
worker community. Okay.
Right. And maybe there should be legislation proposed that requires legislators to know these things.
Okay. Thanks, Anita, for that call. Appreciate it. Columbus Mayor Andrew Ginther signed an executive order 3 years ago prohibiting the use of city resources for the, quote, sole purpose of detecting or apprehending persons based on suspected immigration status. Does that make Columbus a sanctuary city? Is that an issue that's popping up, or has that played out in other states? Heather Prendergast? Heather?
This term, yes, I'm here. The term of sanctuary city is something that, again, it's sort of a smushy term. It can refer to a number of different things, and we've seen these sorts of policies introduced throughout the country. We've also seen policies going the other direction introduced. You know, I think that this legislation is designed to stoke a political base. I don't think it's actually thought out in any way. It sounds like there's still a lot of questions and maybe he'd consider other things. But, you know, I think this doesn't serve to do anything to fix the immigration problems that we have in America. We need to come up with common sense solutions that reflect the realities of what we're seeing and come up with ways to address those issues so that going into the future we can have real change and we don't keep having these same tired arguments. And it's unfortunate that we have politicians that feel the need to continue to draw out these stereotypes.
Okay.
In fact, it's something in the middle.
And Niraj Antani, I just want to give you the last word. We're running out of time, but welcome back. I'm sorry we lost you for a second there.
That's okay. I think I got dropped off.
Look, okay.
You know, obviously immigration is a very impassioned, you know, subject and very emotional. You know, my parents came here legally in 1978, stood in line, followed the law. You know, all of my family has done that. And I think that, you know, the way that, you know, the left cowers to illegal immigrants is a disservice to those of us that had family who came here legally and followed the law. And so, yes, you know, we're going to defund sanctuary cities in Ohio, and we're going to stand up to illegal immigration until our federal government acts.
Niraj Antani, state representative from Ohio's 42nd District, in a suburb of Dayton, and also Heather Prendergast, elected director of the Board of Governors for the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Thanks to both of you. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.